The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England. Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. With its stock market reopening earlier this week to the steepest decline in decades, Greece continues to struggle in the wake of a Eurozone bailout that helped it narrowly avoid total economic collapse. The government of Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras must now turn its attention to continued political unrest and a fast-approaching multi-billion euro loan repayment deadline. Elsewhere in the Eurozone, several countries are also struggling with high debt, sluggish economic growth, and high levels of unemployment. But the economic domino effect that some feared has not come to pass. And there are even a few glimmers of optimism as some countries show signs of regaining their economic footing. All of this while the U.S. government and American investors try to gauge the stability of the European Union and of the debt crisis. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about Greece and the Eurozone. Let's hear from you. What do you think are the biggest economic issues facing the countries of the Eurozone? Have you had any personal experience with the Greek economy or struggling Eurozone members? What do you think are the future holds for the euro currency? Is there a role for the United States to play in fostering European economic stability? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two guests joining me to talk about Greece and the Eurozone this morning. Joining me from Washington, D.C. is Kathleen McNamara. Kathleen is Associate Professor of Government and Foreign Service and Director of the Mortara Center for International Studies at Georgetown University. She has a new book called Politics of Everyday Europe. And Kate, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
I'm delighted to be here.
And joining me from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Matthew Slaughter. Matthew is the Paul Danos Dean of the Tuck School of Business and the Earl C. Baum 1924 Professor of International Studies at Dartmouth College. Matt, it's always good to have you with us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Sure. Before we start talking about Greece, I'd like to give our listeners a little background on what, from the outside, can seem like a complex set of economic relationships and institutions in the Eurozone and the European Union. So let's start with the Eurozone. Matt, let me ask you, just to give our listeners a general sense, what is the function of the Eurozone?
So the Eurozone is a currency arrangement among a subset of the countries that are part of the European Union. So the European Union is a many-decade exercise of Europe to integrate the economies of the separate countries more closely together through agreements to bring down barriers to trade, to free up mobility of labor, to streamline the regulations across countries. And then about 15 years ago, a subset of those countries, today it's 18, agreed to do away with their separate currencies and have just one common currency called the euro. And the economic logic of this was to facilitate even greater economic ties and faster growth by doing away with a lot of the frictions and problems that Europe had experienced by having separate currencies in earlier times.
Kathleen, could you give us a little sense of the broader European Union?
Absolutely. I think Matt did a great job of sort of outlining the logic behind the euro and the economic project that is the European Union. But I would just add that actually I think about the European Union as really having a political end but using economic means. So that originally the European Union is created out of the ashes of World War II, an effort to bring together these countries that have been fighting for decades and decades in a new arrangement that would bind them together in peace and prosperity. And likewise, the Euro project was also conceived of as a way to bind countries together. Importantly, it's really gets off the ground in 1989, which I'm sure everyone can remember was a very monumental year for Europe, with the fall of the Soviet Union and the integration of the former Eastern Germany into Western Germany. So it really was an effort at political goals as much as economic. And I think that's very important to keep in mind when looking at the mess that we have today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Matt, we often hear mention of the Troika, these key institutions, the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, and the European Commission. Could you say a little bit about the important role that they play in all of this?
Sure. Kate did a great job of putting the political and historical context around both the European Union and the Eurozone. So the IMF, if local callers and listeners will remember, came out of an agreement that was hatched in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire in 1944, when the Allied powers began to look ahead to the prospect of having defeated the Axis powers, what the world economy might look like after World War II. So the International Monetary Fund was created to establish a fixed exchange rate regime, meaning many countries around the world at the end of World War II agreed to fix the value of their currencies to the U.S. dollar. And in turn, the U.S. dollar was fixed to the value of gold at $35 an ounce. And that regime lasted and provided some stability in the global economy until the early 1970s, when it fell apart. The European Central Bank, that is Europe's version of the U.S. Federal Reserve. So the European Central Bank is the entity that prints euros and tries to monitor the banking system within Europe. And then the European Commission is a broad economic policy-making agency for all the Eurozone countries and the other members of the EU. So those three institutions each play a somewhat distinct role in the current Greek crisis, but together they've been the main actors that have been interfacing with Prime Minister Tsipras and the Greek government to try to figure out how to bring down their indebtedness and to try to stabilize economic activity in Greece in light of the real crisis they've suffered in recent years.
So those are the key institutions in the crisis. Are there any others that we need to be aware of, or are they sort of the big three?
Boy, they're the big three. The other key set of actors, though, behind this are the individual other countries mm-hmm. in Europe, and especially in the Eurozone, some of the stronger, larger economies in particular of, say, Germany, Greece, or Italy, some of those other countries that are part of the Eurozone, their elected leaders are playing a key role in the negotiations as well about what to do with Greek debt. So it's a very fluid situation where different individuals in different countries have some economic and broader political goals that don't always align with what Greece is trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And Kate, so we have 28 countries in the European Union, I believe, and then 19 in the Eurozone. The relationship between the two, do the individual states, individual countries make the decision to get into the Eurozone, or so why are there some that are in the European Union but not in the Eurozone?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And I will start by saying I've been studying the European Union and the Euro for probably about 20 years or so, and I can barely understand it. So if your listeners are confused by this sort of plethora of actors and different institutions, you know, there's a reason for that. And I think what's important to keep in mind is that the European Union is unique as a political entity. Historically, it really represents an innovative form of governance that is not replicated in any other case. So it really is hard for us to kind of wrap our heads around all the different levels and the different actors and so on and so forth. It doesn't fit the sort of sovereign state model, you know, even in the United States, where we have a federal system, and so we have a lot of different actors that are important in making the rules under which we live. But the European Union, because you have these 28 member states that all have their national rules, and then on top of that, you have the European Union, which sets very broad rules through, they have essentially a Supreme Court, a European Court of Justice, that is the supreme law of the land. But it's not really a federal system because the nation states still have a lot of sovereign power. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the euro, I would say that is the case where it looks the most like what we think of as a national political entity. As Matt says, they have a European Central Bank that governs over those 19 eurozone states. And so you sort of have this core of deeply integrated, politically bound together states within this broader EU. And so it creates, unsurprisingly, a lot of tensions and a lot of conflict, and I would say many of the problems at the core of the Eurozone really stem from this tension around what kind of political entity really is it. It's sort of halfway towards a federal system. It's not just an international organization. It's something much more profound, but it's something that really has not been fully formed to work properly.
Yeah. Now, Matt, is it fair to say that these 19 countries, they essentially have the same monetary policy, even though they have very different economic conditions, or is there sort of variation for what they can do in terms of monetary policy?
Great question. So they do share a common monetary policy. And what that means is the 19 countries that have given up their independent currencies and agree to have the euro be the only unit of account and settlement of payments for the typical day-to-day business transactions, the amount of euros in circulation are determined by the European Central Bank as it looks at the overall economic conditions in those 19 countries. So the parallel for us here in the United States is the Federal Reserve. They create monetary policy for all 50 of the U.S. states. They have to consider the different economic conditions across the 50 different U.S. states. So, for example, right now in the U.S., with the collapse in oil prices in the past several months, the economies of Texas, of North Dakota, these big oil-producing states, are struggling much more than, say, New Hampshire is, because we don't produce a lot of oil here. Yet the Fed has to try to balance these different regional considerations. The same balance has to be struck by the European Central Bank. And the pressure economically right now that they face is Greece, and to a lesser extent, but importantly, the same qualitative way, other countries in the Eurozone, such as Spain and Portugal, their economies are struggling with very high unemployment. In all those countries, the unemployment rate is over 20% today, for example. And yet, as Kate rightly pointed out, there's these policy and political considerations that the ECB has to be aware of. And part of the challenge that the ECB faces is it's conducting monetary policy for all these countries, even though many of their other economic policies, such as taxes and transfers that their federal governments make, aren't as closely integrated as they are in the United States.
Is that something that is that by plan or by choice?
Well, it's been by plan. They created the common currency, this common monetary policy, without having any strong agreement across the member countries about coordination of their fiscal policies, that is, of how much taxes are raised and through what tax means in individual countries, right, and how this federal spending across those countries might be shared. That's right. Very different from the United States.
Right, so that's a separate set of decisions. We're going to turn our attention to Greece in particular after the break. We'll be back shortly, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're discussing the Greek debt crisis and what it means for the Eurozone. We invite you to call in at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us a short email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And I have two guests joining me this morning for the conversation. Kate McNamara, she's an associate professor of government at Georgetown University, where she's also director of the Mortara Center for International Studies. And Matthew Slaughter, he's the dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, where he's also a professor of international business. And folks, let's turn our attention now specifically to Greece. And Kate, let me start with you, just kind of with a general sense of what has happened in Greece in the last couple of months, the last-minute negotiations, the referendum, and now it sounds like there's the potential of a bailout.
Absolutely. So Greece has long been considered somewhat of the weak link, I would say, of the euro. It's a country that came in a little bit later than the original founding countries. It's always been a country that has been viewed as having a much weaker set of political institutions to support economic policy making. And during the sort of go-go years of the aughts, when we had a lot of sort of financial expansion across the world, this was sort of masked and hidden, the problems with Greece. Greece ended up borrowing a lot of money because it had joined the euro, and financial markets seemed to be I'm maybe experiencing a bit of amnesia about the real realities of the Greek situation. And so they lent Greece quite a lot of money over the 2000s. When the global financial crisis hit, it became apparent that the Greek economy had a levels of debt that were simply unsustainable, that Greece, in fact, was an economy that was not healthy, that was not going to be able to grow its way out of its borrowing. And so in 2010, we started what really has been this sort of five-year wrenching Greek debt crisis, which has resulted in a series of crises around the financing of that debt. The most important thing to note is that the debt was basically moved from private investors to public authorities, so that now Greek debt is really held by other member states of the European Union, European Union institutions, and the IMF. And so we've seen a series of crises around whether the Greeks could repay the debt, and on the other hand, the creditors demanding that the Greeks pursue a variety of quite difficult reforms and also pursue policies of what's called austerity, very tight policies to do a lot of budget cutting with the public spending and so on. And it really has came to sort of a deadlock just last month when a new party had been elected in January to push back on these very difficult reform requests and austerity policies. And there was a series of very dramatic events, which we can talk about, around the negotiations. Mm-hmm. So at the moment, the debt crisis was once again sort of kicked down the road, as they say, and right now the creditors are once again negotiating with the Greeks over the extent of the reforms.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, I want to get your take on this as well, but let's go to the phones first. We have Bob joining us from Alton. Bob, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. My comment may be oversimplistic, but taking in consideration the Eurozone, the European Union, the IMF, the simplistic thought that I had was for Greece to open up its economic door, so to speak, and invite in all of the top European economists, especially where, you know, they actually hold some of the debt themselves, and to review all of Greece's much in depth their social, political, economic problems, and advise Greece on how best to proceed in resolving this economic issue there. And again, I say this may be over simplistic, and I think that everybody's kind of talking around and saying the same thing. So that's my comment. And it's the only way I can see that this could actually eventually get resolved. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Bob. Matt, let me turn to you on that comment.
Sure. Bob, the thought actually isn't simplistic. It's actually a pretty deep one, and it connects with the framing that Kate nicely provided. Greece right now, if you focus on where its economy is today, it has suffered in the past 5 years effectively a Great Depression, like what the United States and many countries suffered in the late 1920s and early 1930s. So the total output of the Greek economy has fallen by about 25%, what economists call gross domestic product, in the past 5 years, roughly. Unemployment today is about 25% for the whole Greek economy. For the young in Greece, those aged 25 and younger, unemployment today is at about 50%. So many economists, as Bob pointed out, what they are recommending in places like the IMF and the European Central Bank to try to stimulate economic growth and job creation is a set of what economists tend to call structural reforms. The challenge is those structural reforms are oftentimes very difficult in the short term because they impose costs on people that have some protections provided by the government in product markets, for example, where they don't face a lot of competition from foreign companies. And the economic benefit of those often arises over many years, not immediately. So Bob's insight about sort of inviting in advice has been happening, and this speaks to one of the political challenges Kate nicely pointed out, though. Many people in Greece feel, justly or not, that these foreign voices coming in and telling them what to do to reform their economy don't have moral or political standing to do so. And so Prime Minister Tsipras has been trying to balance an electorate and a population in Greece that's both scared and feeling indignant about the economic situation they find themselves in, against mainly other creditor nations within Europe that say, well, this is a mess that you are in, and to move forward, you have to implement these difficult structural reforms.
Mm-hmm. Bob, thanks for that call. And Kate, let's talk a little bit about the political context here. My recollection was that, you know, there was this referendum in Greece. The prime minister had a referendum that rejected austerity measures, but then it kind of seemed like shortly thereafter he took the deal anyway. And there was some discussion that, you know, sort of leftist parties in a number of these Mediterranean countries would kind of use this as a kind of a pretext for broader reforms. Just say a little bit to us about kind of the political context here.
I think what the Greek situation really has pointed out is that unfortunately there's no kind of obvious and clear good options for a country like Greece that has gotten in a situation where they, borrowed way too much. They have these deep structural and political problems. And so it really has been terribly frustrating, I think, for everyone around the negotiating table. But I think there's one more kind of political and economic factor that I wanted to bring up, and that's the question of debt relief for Greece. I think most people agree that when you have a country like Greece that, for example, is not able to actually collect tax receipts, that doesn't have an independent statistical agency to even provide clear economic data about what's happening in the country, that there really are structural things that need to be changed. However, on the other side, interestingly, you've had even the IMF, which generally is thought of as a very sober and orthodox and sort of financially sound institution, saying that there's no way the Greeks are ever going to be able to repay back these debts. That in fact, the creditor countries like Germany, need to continue to write down or write off these debts for Greece to have any chance of getting back on its feet. But interestingly, Germany has this long history of wanting to see its partner countries be as economically sober and sound as it has been in the post-war era. Interestingly, not the Germany before World War II, but the post-war Germany has really been sort of the exemplar of how to run a sound economic policy and an export-oriented economy and be successful. And so Germany has really dug in their heels in the form of Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. Mm-hmm. So that has created a tremendous amount of tension in Europe, because Germany and Merkel and her finance minister are all seen as blocking the chances for Greece to get back on its feet again.
Mm-hmm. I want to let our listeners know we're talking about the Eurozone today, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook. My guests today are Kathleen McNamara of Georgetown University and Matthew Slaughter of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. Kate and Matt, let's go back to the phones, and we have Thomas joining us from Somerville. Thomas, welcome to the Exchange.
Somersworth, New Hampshire. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Your question.
Yes. First, I'd like to give you a historical point. I come from Greece, as you can understand from my accent, and I have very close ties to my old country. Back in the late 70s, when the prime minister there, Konstantinos Karamanlis, decided to put Greece into the European Union, he knew very well that Greece was not able to compete with any of those nations that it was getting into. But he did it because Greece was facing a lot of problems on the eastern border from Turkey. And it was spending a lot of money from its GDP to defend the nation's borders. With that in mind, he decided to put Greece into the European Union, hoping that the borders of Greece on the eastern, it will be European borders. Therefore, it would free the money to so he could put it into infrastructure projects, hospitals, and so on and so forth. That's for the history. The point I like to make is that, in my opinion, it's not a coincidence that all southern Europe is in trouble. The European Union was tailor-made for the northern industrial European nations. I will give you an example. Germany and its satellite states, such as Austria, Denmark, Luxembourg, Belgium, and Holland, are the heart of the European Union. You don't hear any of these nations in trouble. And they're able to put their agenda forward constantly. And in my opinion, it's what the European Union is all about. It's about those nations driving their agenda, and everyone else has to follow. Otherwise, it will be in trouble like the southern Europeans are.
Thomas, thanks for that call. Matt, let me turn to you. You hear a lot about what Thomas was talking about, North versus South, creditor versus debtor, Germany versus some of these other countries. Say a little bit about the dynamics there.
Sure. The dynamics are pretty complicated, both in terms of the economics and the politics, as Thomas's comments underscored. In terms of the economics, when people talk about debt relief, the reality is that means creditors incur economic losses. Now, that might be appropriate and necessary, but I think it's important to underscore that the use of sometimes what I think is a euphemism of debt relief means certain economic actors are bearing the costs of the debtors not being able to repay. And this speaks to Thomas's intervention, which is the creditors today of Greek debt, they're no longer private banks, as Kate nicely pointed out earlier. Part of what's happened in recent years is the fear of a financial crisis arising because a lot of the Greek government debt was held by banks and possibly triggering another financial crisis. Institutions like the European Commission and the IMF and individual countries supporting those payments, like Germany, bought up the debt of the Greek government. So the losses being incurred thus far, because there's been two restructurings of the Greek debt, and if there's another restructuring, as might happen in the future, those losses ultimately are borne by the taxpayers of the Netherlands, of Germany, of those northern countries that Thomas talked about. And fairly or not, this speaks to the underlying political tension that exists within the Eurozone overall, and more generally within the EU, about how much support one country should provide to another country to support the standard of living of individuals and of workers and families. I'll compare it with the United States. In the United States, we don't have large political disputes over the fact that when there's downturns, again, to talk about today with Texas and North Dakota and other oil-producing states suffering with the downturn in prices, that taxpayer money from New Hampshire and from Vermont and states like that support workers and their families in those states that are hurt by the downturn in oil prices. But Europe politically hasn't gotten that far along in terms of what people sometimes refer to as a fiscal union. And that underscores the kind of tensions that Thomas was referring to in his call.
And Thomas, thanks again for that call.
Yes, can I jump,
absolutely,
jump in on that?
Yep.
Thank you. I think that the caller really does bring up a lot of really important and, as Matt says, complicated relationships and values and so on. But I like very much this point about in the United States, you know, when we have this sort of fiscal transfers that have to happen, it happens invisibly. We don't discuss whether Texas should get more money if Texas has a downturn, because Texas will, you know, money will flow to Texas in unemployment insurance and various types of infrastructure projects and so on. Whereas in the European Union, because they don't have this automatic sort of fiscal setup, everything becomes highly politicized. And I was thinking in the U.S. case, the only time that we really see this is over things like disaster relief, say the cleanup of after Katrina or of Sandy. You know, then we do see members of Congress debating about how much money should go to what region of the United States. But really, politically, federal systems hold together in part because we have these institutions such that we don't have to make these types of debates public every single time there's some sort of disjuncture economically.
And Matt, speaking of politics, Tom from Rye writes in and asks about the impact of the Greek Olympic Games on the current debt levels and economic problems they have. And I must say, I was in Greece both before and after the Olympics, and, you know, they have the new airport and the subway system and a lot of other public works projects. What was the role of all that in the crisis?
A great question. I think Greece's Olympics, like most other cities and countries when they host a summer or winter games, the research is pretty clear that there is a short-term economic bump from all of the construction that happens. But then over time, once the games have finished and the torch is extinguished, there's not a lot of persistent economic benefit from the construction that goes on. And Greece funded part of those Olympic games by issuing some debt. The broader debt problem that the Greek government finds itself in today and the Greek people had a much broader set of contributions, though, beyond the Greek Olympics. One of the fundamental things, frankly, that, and this speaks to the tension politically in Europe, was for many years the Greek government was systematically underreporting the size of its fiscal deficit to the European authorities in other countries. And so at a fundamental level, one of the challenges that within the Eurozone right now is fragile or non-existent trust between the Greek government and, to some extent, the Greek people and other countries.
Mm-hmm. Kate, Fred from Lee emailed us, and he wants to know, he says many economists say Greece would be better off leaving the euro. What do you think about that?
Oh, boy, as I said, no good options here. The Greek drachma was a very unstable currency. It was prone to inflationary spirals. It would depreciate on world markets. It would make it very hard for Greece to have a stable functioning economy. That being said, the euro has tended to be a strong currency, and that makes Greece expensive when tourists go to Greece. American tourists, we have to change our money into euros, and until recently, the euro was actually a pretty expensive currency for vis-a-vis the American dollar. So certainly if they had their own currency again, they could let that currency depreciate. That would make Greece an attractive vacation spot for folks. But unfortunately, Greece does not actually have a strong export economy, so it's not clear to me.
Kate, we got to take a quick break, and we'll come back with more. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today we're discussing the current situation in the Eurozone. You can join us by calling 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook. My guest for the show today, Kathleen McNamara. She's an associate professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. She has a new book, The Politics of Everyday Europe. And Matthew Slaughter, he is the Paul Danos Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, where he is also a professor of international business. And Kate, I want to come back to you. We ran out of time there before the break. You were talking about the pros and cons of Greece leaving the euro.
Yeah, that was sort of unfair because that's not an easy question to answer in a minute, is it? You know, and you saw where I was going with that, that basically
yes.
It's not like it's some sort of silver bullet to have their own currency again. You know, and I think if you look at countries like Spain and Portugal and Italy, which one of the callers had talked about, sort of Southern Europe being harmed by many of the European policies, there are many people in those countries that would argue that actually the euro has been a good thing, that it actually has allowed them to stabilize their economies, which tended to be viewed with suspicion by international markets because, like Greece, they tended to be not as stable. So I think the question is, staying in the euro, if Greece can undertake some of these reforms that we've talked about, then in the long run it will certainly be a good thing for Greece to stay in. But as we know, sort of external regime change is very hard to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, I should mention that you recently testified in Congress before a Senate Banking Committee subcommittee. And so your thoughts on whether or not Greece should leave the euro?
I thought Kate did a very nice job in summarizing the trade-offs. I think the broader issue is Greece's economic future has very little to do with what kind of currency arrangement it has. The economic history is very clear that countries can thrive in floating exchange rate regimes, they can thrive in currency unions, they can struggle in floating exchange rate regimes, or they can struggle in currency unions. So I think the more fundamental question facing Greece today is whether the current government under Prime Minister Tsipras or any other government after it will be able to foster growth in Greece's labor force and capital investments and productivity. That's the basic question that faces Greece. And I'll say that's the basic question that faces most of the other countries in Europe, both Southern and Northern Europe, and to some extent even the United States. Most advanced countries today, like Greece, we have aging populations. Those aging populations bring greater fiscal pressures in terms of payments in the United States on Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, all at a time where some of the most dynamic global companies that do the really innovative discovery of new ideas and research and development, they have many more options around the world for where they're going to make those investments in jobs and ideas and capital. So for Greece, one of the challenges is as more and more time gets spent on these immediate issues of how are we going to make this particular payment to the European Central Bank this week, that crowds out the ability to focus on what could the Greek economy look like in 5 years or 10 years. And that's a more fundamental question.
Mm-hmm. And Kate and Matt, let's go back to the phones. We have Kirsten joining us from Manchester. Kirsten, welcome to the exchange.
Good morning. Thank you for accepting my call.
Sure.
And I'd like to give my greatest thanks to your panel on their research because it's exactly right. And I would like to share my personal experience. I am a fashion designer, American, originally from New York City. In the 80s, I went to Italy to manufacture my fashion. I remained there for 30 years in Italy. I returned to the United States just last year, 2014, which means in 2011, I experienced the economic default in Italy. I lost everything, like many Italians did, homes, businesses of generations, many suicides. At the end of 2012, Milan was considered the black net of 17,000 homeless people in the street, in which you can walk over their bodies. Returning to the United States, and I felt that I had a second chance more than many other people that had to remain in Italy. The euro cannot work. The governments know that. As they live on their three pensions, and triple salaries, their fees. The austerity plan did not work. They changed the pension plan in which they promised those that are eligible at 60, at the age of 62 to go on the on their pension. Okay, they were left also jobless. The changing of the pension was against the rule, and then the courts were able to put the pension plan back onto within the Italian constitution where it was made and is now being. It's impossible for Europe to work. It's not like the United States, like Kate and her.
Well, Kirsten,
yes.
thank you for sharing your story with us. Kate, Kirsten talking about kind of almost a political cynicism there in the Eurozone. Your take on her experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I would say I'm very sorry to hear about what a traumatic and awful experience that she personally had and she witnessed around her in Italy. I suppose I see the dynamics as not necessarily directly linked to the euro alone. I think that there were, you know, the global financial crisis, of course, brought a lot of devastation in its wake, not only in Europe, but in the United States as well. And clearly, the policies that are being that are flowing from the euro, which do emphasize, as she says, austerity and macroeconomic tightening in various countries in Europe are clearly the wrong policies. They're making things worse, I think. There's no doubt about it. But I think that even without the euro, we would have seen a lot of difficulty and devastation. Again, if Italy still had the lira, they would have seen their currency, you know, fall through the floor in terms of depreciation. That would have made it very expensive for Italy to buy anything from abroad, including oil. So, you know, again, not great options either way. But I think that what I'm hoping for, actually, and what I think we should all look for in the future is a revival of the role of France in particular, that Germany and Angela Merkel have really been driving the conversation about these policies. And traditionally, France and the French presidents have tended to moderate the German emphasis on austerity in the European Union. And that voice has really been missing. So I'm really looking to whether François Hollande, the current president of France, whether he's going to be able to sort of revive his political fortunes and play more of a role in moving to a better set of policies.
Mm-hmm. And Kirsten, thanks again for your call and for sharing your experience. Matt, Kirsten's call and Kate's comments raise a larger issue for me. As I was preparing for the show, I read a number of economists who said that focus on austerity is a mistake, that what's needed is fiscal stimulus and looser monetary policy. Where do you come down on that particular debate?
I totally understand that in the short term, governments, when they cut taxes and or increase spending and they finance that through borrowing, that stimulates economic activity in the short term. And as Kate pointed out earlier, the International Monetary Fund, their best guess is the amount of total debt that the Greek government has today outstanding, even after two defaults and restructurings they've already had in the past 5 years, is probably unsustainable. And yet, there's a fundamental question of who's going to buy the debt and at what price are they going to buy the debt. And that's very unclear as we look to the future, because already countries in the Eurozone and pretty much everywhere else in the world, their governments have taken on a tremendous amount of additional debt in the past several years. So if you look at data that the IMF puts together, for example, from 2007 to today, the total debt outstanding of federal governments in the Eurozone has risen from about 66% of their gross domestic product, that's a measure of their total output, to about 94%. In Italy, that Kirsten shared her insights on, the debt outstanding rose from about 103% to 133%. So the big open question, frankly, is if these governments want to continue to borrow more, who's going to buy the debt? The problem for many governments over the many centuries is at some point, if the private creditors start to worry about the capacity or desire of the governments to repay that debt, in some metaphorical and literal sense, they don't show up at the debt auctions. Mm-hmm. And I think Kirsten's call was really insightful, and I'll connect it with Thomas's call earlier. They're two living examples of individuals who were part of the European economy who have migrated out. And I don't say that with any judgment, but take Kirsten. She was a fashion designer. She produced and hired people and had economic activity in Italy for decades. And yet, because of the difficult economic policies there right now, she has departed Italy. And that's one of the challenges for the Eurozone and the European Union more generally, is some of the brightest individuals, the entrepreneurs and young people, they're the ones with the most opportunity that are literally leaving countries like Greece for other parts of the Eurozone that are more dynamic, or leaving the Eurozone altogether.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes remaining, and I think that this conversation provides a nice segue into talking a little bit about the United States. Kirsten mentioned that she's back in the U.S. Throughout the Greek euro crisis, I constantly saw stories on the news and with titles like "What does the Greek economic crisis mean for your 401k?" So the American media trying to kind of bring this home. Let me go to you, Kate. What's your general sense of the relationship or the impact of all of this on the U.S. economy, or alternatively, you know, how do you see American governmental institutions being involved? You can kind of take it whichever way you want.
Mm-hmm. So Europe remains the United States' most important partner, both economically and politically. Even though, you know, we all talk a lot about China and American investments in China and Chinese buying our T-bills and all that sort of thing, it turns out that the transatlantic relationship is the most significant economic relationship we have with a partner country or area in the world. And so obviously whatever happens in Europe is important to anyone in the United States who wants to export or invest in the EU. Now, as we've discussed, there are, of course, parts of the EU that have been growing and doing much better. So Ireland, for example, which was caught up in this debt crisis early on, has actually really rebounded, and we're seeing a lot more activity and investment in Ireland. But it is very concerning when we have such slow growth and such high unemployment in this partner country, our economic partner. And then, of course, politically, you know, the United States and Europe, we share such fundamental values. We share such fundamental foreign policy goals. Anytime you have a region that is so distracted by this series of, you know, really grinding 5 years of crisis, it's going to make it much harder for Europe to be our partner in geopolitical sense. So I think it continues to be worrisome, I imagine, for anyone involved in U.S. foreign policy or in U.S. Economic policy making.
Matt, should we be worried about our 401ks with this, or not a big impact?
Yeah, Dean, that's a great question. The short answer is almost surely not, meaning no disrespect to the good people of Greece. It's a country of about 11 million people. The size of its economy is about the size of the economy of Louisiana or Connecticut. And so the economic downturn in Greece and the slow growth, yes, it's real economic hardship for the people and families there. Yet for what that means for American business, it's pretty, pretty small. The one concern people have, thus the headlines like what you refer to, is if Greek has an involuntary default in debt again, and or if they exit the Eurozone, some combination of those two financial market events might somehow trigger another systemic financial crisis like the world saw in 2008 and 2009. Now, the odds of that are pretty low, and the main reason for that is because who holds most of Greek government debt today is not other banks that might be prone to instability and bank runs. Who owns most of the Greek government today is other governments, like we talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. So the odds of it affecting our 401k are pretty low. You can never rule out crises by definition. But I think in your good question, I think the bigger lesson and question that Greece raises for the United States is one some of our callers alluded to and we've talked a bit about, which is, well, what's the economic future for the United States? Some of the same forces that are afflicting the Greek economy today are forces that are facing the United States. We have an aging population. Economic growth has slowed quite dramatically in recent years. Incomes for very few families are rising. And so the sense of economic unease that's present in the United States shares a lot of similarities with the economic unease in Greece. It's nowhere near as acute, surely. But as we look ahead to the future of the United States and as we think about the presidential campaign coming up and people coming through New Hampshire, I'd love to hear a bit more conversation about these longer-term economic issues that Greece represents for many other countries, the United States included.
Mm-hmm. Kate, we only have about a minute and a half left or so, but I wanted to get your kind of final thoughts. So where do you think all this is headed in Europe, either in terms of kind of the euro or the union more generally?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. If you look historically at single currencies, the euro is the only single currency that exists outside of a single sovereign nation state. Single currencies have always been the product of larger political projects, usually actually involving violence, conflict, war, right? So we get a single currency in the United States only with the Civil War, actually. That's when we move from having lots of different currencies circulating in sort of a very chaotic situation to having a single currency, because Lincoln needed a single currency to pay the troops, to raise revenues, et cetera. And single currencies, because they're so it's such a big step, they've really only come within these larger moments of crisis, of political change. So the big question for the EU is whether they're going to move to have these other component parts that will support the currency, like the fiscal union. Is this crisis big enough to let us see a change towards a more cohesive, more federalized Europe or not? That's the big question.
Okay. You think Greece is going to hang in there? Kate?
Oh, boy. I think they are. You know, the majority of people in Greece still want to stay within the euro. The European Union represents modernity. As our caller said, it represents democracy, it represents peace and stability, and I think that there still is, despite all these problems, there still is commitment to try to stay within the EU and within the euro.
Well, we'll be watching closely. We are out of time. I'd like to thank my guests for joining us for the show this morning. Kate, we really appreciate you being with us. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Kathleen McNamara. She's Associate Professor of Government and Foreign Service and Director of the Mortara Center for International Studies at Georgetown University. She has a new book called The Politics of Everyday Europe, and she joined us from Washington, D.C. And Matt, it's always good to have you with us on The Exchange. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dean. Always a pleasure.
That's Matthew Slaughter, the Paul Danos Dean of the Tuck School of Business and the Earl C. Baum 1924 Professor of International Studies at Dartmouth College. He joined us from Hanover, New Hampshire. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and our intern is Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.